General attitudes would say this is a good time to be a woman. For the first time in U.S. history, women make up half of the educated labor force and are earning the majority of advanced degrees. Not so, though, when you look more closely, say Carol Rivers and Rosalind C. Barnett. Instead, women have to fight what they dub the new soft war on women in their book of the same name, now released in paperback. I spoke with Rivers about what that war is and how it plays out, both in everyday life and in politics.
Well, it's interesting, rather shocking, actually, that, in fact, when women do all this work, if they're working in conjunction with a male, even when they're the senior person and the male is very junior, it's astonishing how people assume that the male was the lead person. We interviewed women, for example, who said they did all the work, and then they would go in front of, say, a board or in front of their boss, and all the questions would be asked to the male, who was very junior. And in some cases, the man got promoted, and the woman did not. So there seems to be this assumption that, you know, men are the serious people, and that when men and women work together, the woman is the junior partner. And that seems very outdated, the hangover from the old days, but it's very real. It's in people's heads. And interestingly enough, women as well as men sometimes have these attitudes. And the same kind of thing is operating when men are promoted on possibility and women on performance. And many of our people we interviewed said, well, here I was doing this work, and they hired this hotshot 28-year-old who basically hadn't done anything yet. But they were so thrilled about his degree or his possibilities that he was given assignments instead of the woman who'd actually proved herself. And we heard a lot of women who told that story.
And on that notion of men being seen as very hardworking, you cite some studies and say that in absence of evidence to the contrary, men are assumed to be hardworking, success-oriented, and dedicated to the welfare organization. But not so for women who don't get that automatic pass, and that's backed up by a number of stories, including one of a woman who finally went to the ER from the stress of trying to outperform in order to be considered equal and was told by the doctor, oh, you're from that firm? Yeah, we get one or two of you women every single week.
Exactly. And you find that this assumption that it's almost when the man walks in the door, he's assumed to be, he's going to work hard, he's ambitious, he's going to be an asset to the company. Whereas the woman walks in the door and she has to prove it. So that women do look around and say, wait a minute, I've proved this over and over and over again. Why do I have to prove it yet again? Whereas my male colleague, who in some cases is not as good, gets the benefit of the doubt. And once again, it's this unconscious stuff we've got in our heads that we don't even realize is there.
Mm-hmm. And we do see some companies being well-meaning and trying, and they create these mentorship programs or these sponsorship programs for the women in their organization to try and bring them up. But you look at these and you say, hey, wait a second, these aren't really working that well. We're not seeing a lot of promotions from them. We're just seeing women have extra work without a lot of payoff.
The research shows that men tend more to get sponsors, and the difference is the sponsor is somebody who goes out on a limb for you. The sponsor will go to your supervisor or to somebody influential and say, hey, you got to take a look at Mary F. here. She's fabulous. Whereas the mentor will just say, let's talk about what you need and how tough it is and all this kind of stuff. They get a lot of advice, but the mentor doesn't take the next step of putting her butt on the line or his butt on the line for you if you're female. So it's really important to make that distinction between sponsors and mentors.
And there's the difference we're seeing. And also sort of on the line of people who will stick out their neck and defend you. We hear in the business world again and again things like fail fast, failure is necessary, failure is a great teacher. But all the time, women are kind of afraid to take the big chances that might lead to big successes because they're finding that they're not given the ability to fail to the same extent.
This is really true, and it is particularly true in tech, where there's an old boy network, and say if the guy flies to somewhere to fix the routers that have failed and he doesn't fix them, he comes back, he gets patted on the back and saying, you tried, you really did a good job. A woman in the same situation, she goes, she tries and fails, she's gone. So that we heard that complaint a lot from women in corporate America that, you know, you've got one shot, and maybe it's because people in their heads have this idea, well, women can't do it anyhow. So when they fail, that confirms the stereotype. where a man, well, he's going to fail maybe now and then, but basically he can do it. He's got the right stuff. And I think that accounts for the no second chances syndrome, which is pretty extensive.
Which reminds me of a newer term you threw out. We're all very familiar with the idea of the glass ceiling, but you have two more terms in your book, the glass cliff and the glass escalator. Can you share what you're finding there?
Yes, one of the things that the glass cliff research shows is that very often women are promoted to top job just at the point when the company is in failure mode. So I guess the thinking is everything's going to hell in a handcart anyhow, let's put the woman in and it'll be her fault. Or, hey, we've tried everything out, maybe this will work. So this sets women up to fail if you were promoted to the top job. Only at a time when everything seems to be lost, the chances are that you will fail. And that's a problem. And the glass escalator is interesting because this applies to female-dominated jobs. And research finds that men move up faster in those female-dominated jobs. And they're often promoted by female supervisors more often than they promote other females. And it may be, again, the unconscious bias that he's a guy, he needs to be promoted, the guy, he can do it better, or, gee, we got to promote a man so we won't look like we're discriminated. But what Dalti is, of course, is that men move up faster.
So some of this, too, we're seeing is coming from, it's coming from a lot of things, but I think one of the things many women know well, and, you know, I myself experience a lot, is the tightrope we have to walk with the likability conundrum.
Yeah, and this is research that's really fascinating and disturbing. The idea when men are competent and forceful, they are automatically assumed to be likable. When women are competent and forceful, they're assumed to be the B word. And there was a wonderful experience where in business school, a resume was handed out. It was an actual resume of a woman who was quite successful. But they put different names. They put Howard and Heidi. And when the students read it, they rated Heidi and Howard as equally competent. But they really said Howard was a good boss and likable. And they said that Heidi was self-centered and selfish. Same resume.
Yeah.
I think one of the things we need is workshops in companies to start examining things and saying, look, here's what you're thinking inside, and here's why you're thinking it. And, I mean, many women are surprised to say, oh, my gosh, I have those thoughts. Even though I'm a woman, even though I'm a feminist, I fall into this trap. So I think the messages of this sort of subterranean underground discrimination is not good for the bottom line. The more we can get companies to let their managers know, let their employees know that this kind of thing is going on, that's at least a first step toward eliminating some of this discrimination.
On this idea of the emotions tightrope we have to walk, you can see it play out pretty clearly in politics. Vice President Biden is rightly very emotional after the death of his son, and the vice president is found much more likable and realistic. But then when you compare that to Secretary Clinton, her previous campaign, she was considered too rigid until she showed two tears, and suddenly she's too emotional, becomes well-loved as Secretary of State, and again, she's back to the position she was in before Secretary of State.
Absolutely. I think Hillary Clinton is a very, very good example. But she kind of can't win, as you say. If she's emotional, she is, she's a woman, she can't be tough enough. I mean, and nobody seems to care that John Boehner seems to weep every second day. That's not a problem. And then again, the likability factor is coming up. They're now saying, well, she's not authentic, she's not real. And women in politics have this issue. Another thing that happens is that, well, women sort of get a bonus because people sort of trust women. They think they're more honest. But if women are perceived to slip, they get punished much harder than men. And you see this, I think, in the email scandal. It looks like when all the investigations are through that Secretary Clinton did nothing wrong. And yet her numbers are going down, I think, because she's now being portrayed as untrustworthy. And she's being punished harder for that than a man might be who had done the same thing.
Is this probably a large part how we've managed to go so long in our history as a country without a female president? I mean, looking at it, this campaign is far from sure at the moment, but it's looking like the best chance we've ever had.
It's absolutely true that you find that the attitudes toward women, we find that women, number one, they tend to be older when they first run, so it's harder for them to get up high. they tend to run much less often. As a recent new study showing that young men are twice as likely to think about a career in politics as are women. And then when women do run and younger women see how they're treated, that also turns women off. I mean, do I want to get into this race and have my cleavage and my thighs and my face? The recent Donald Trump comment about Carly Fiorina's face. Has any male candidate's face been mentioned in any kind of debates? Of course not. So I think women face substantially higher and greater barriers if they're running for high office than men do.
Have you seen any evidence of things that we as women civilians, or as all civilians, can do to encourage more women to run?
Well, I think there's certainly organizations, Emily List, which is trying to raise money, and groups that are trying to encourage women to try to aim high in politics, aim for the White House. But when you look around, when you look at, for example, the Republican debate stage, before Carly Fiorina got moved up, the main debate stage was entirely male. We have, I think, a really long way to go. And I think the key thing is we need to get a woman in the office. So there will be a role model so we can see a woman who's there and we can say, ah, guess what? The world did not fall apart.
Is this, do you think, related to the opt-out, what is sometimes called revolution, of people claiming that women are leaving the workforce voluntarily to raise families, even though you're finding that it's largely duress and companies that aren't willing to be a little flexible? Partly that by the time they'd get to the point of running for higher office, they're just done?
Part of it, although we know the opt-out revolution was no revolution, that basically all the women that the New York Times interviewed for that story are now back in the workplace. So it isn't that women are just leaving the workplace for home and hearth. It's simply that they are running sometimes into situations that are so difficult. For example, I think one woman lawyer just had a new baby and she was nursing and she was told she had to go live for 3 months in another city, hundreds of miles away, to keep her job. So it is not that women are pining to go home. It's that the work situations can often be extremely difficult. And I think we see that in politics, too, because women don't jump in to run for high office. A man, for example, if he decides, I want to be in politics, might well start running for Congress, whereas a woman rarely does that. She says, well, I'll go and work for my town school committee. And by the time she's ready to run for Congress, she's considerably older and will not rise as fast.
And one more thing on this emotion and likability trend. It was surprising to me until I really thought about it. You were finding that women aren't really naturally more caring as we're branded. We just internalize this idea that we are and that it really gets in the way. You write that until we retire sugar and spice to the scrap heap of history, women will never be equal.
Absolutely, because many women feel that they have to always be the caring one when they're at work. I've seen this in academia where a student is having a problem, the men dive under the desk and they send the women out to cope with this problem, and it's very stressful. So a lot of times women get a lot of stress because they're always the one that has to be in charge of caring, and sometimes they're not really good at it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how we need men to work with us. How do we encourage the men we work with who seem to get it and seem to care about creating an equal playing field to feel engaged and empowered to work on this issue too?
Again, I think we need to talk about this a lot. My co-author and I were at a workshop, and it was interesting that we saw, I think it was for the first time, we saw almost as many men in this workshop about discrimination against women as there were women. And what often happens in these companies, you have the workshop about women, and 300 women show up, and no men show up. And we were actually at a workshop at a prestigious medical school where exactly that happened. I think there was one man in the audience. So we have to make sure that when we have these conversations, that the men are in the room.
So with all the research you've looked at and with the time you've spent on this issue, what do you tell young women when you meet them?
first thing we say is be aware. Understand that these things exist. Don't believe what you're hearing from the media that women have it made, men are all failing, and women are taking over the world, because you look at what's really happening and you see that while women were making great strides during the 90s, that has halted. And we're seeing stalling out or moving backwards. You know, fewer women on boards, fewer women among high earners, fewer women moving up the ladder, particularly as you get beyond the entry level. So women have to understand that the battles aren't won. They're tougher now because they're harder to see, but you really have to be aware that they're there.
And young men?
I think young men have to realize that they have a big stake, too, in having women succeed, because we know that one reason that many men are in the middle class and haven't fallen out of the middle class is because there's two incomes. So very often, a man who is married or has a partner, his economic future depends very strongly on his partner or spouse. And the same thing in companies, that we know that when companies do well, it's often because they have a substantial number of women up in the higher echelon. So it's a win-win for men as well as for women.
Well, thank you very, very much for your book.
And thank you very much.
That was Carol Rivers, a journalist, professor, and the author of The New Soft War on Women, How the Myth of Ascendance is Hurting Women, Men, and Our Economy. I'm Amanda Hunnick-Fort. Thank you for listening.